I was as choosy as a pedigreed woman seeking love. You can't be too fat or too tall or have any communicable diseases. Following a 3-week sojourn in a university refrigerator, the cadaver wound up here. I have agreed to disguise any identifying features, though I suspect that the dehydrating air of refrigeration has gotten a jump on the task. He looks gaunt and desiccated, something of the old parsnip about him. Before the embalming begins, the exterior of the corpse is cleaned and groomed, as it would be, were this man to be displayed in an open casket or presented to the family for a private viewing. In reality, when the students are through, no one but the cremation furnace attendant will see him. Nicole swabs the mouth and eyes with disinfectant, then rinses both with a jet of water. Though I knew the man to be dead, I expect to see him flinch when the cotton swab hits his eye, to cough and sputter when the water hits the back of his throat. His stillness, his deadness, is surreal. The students move purposely. Nicole is looking in the man's mouth. Her hand rests sweetly on his chest. Concerned, she calls Theo over to look. They talk quietly, and then he turns to me. "There's material sitting in the mouth," he says. I nod, picturing corduroy, swatches of gingham. "Material?" "Purge," offers Nicole. It's not helping. Hugh, Mac McMonagall, an instructor at the college who is supervising this morning's session, steps up beside me. What happened is that whatever was in the stomach found its way into the mouth. Gases created by bacterial decay build up and put pressure on the stomach, squeezing its contents back up the esophagus and into the mouth. The situation appears not to bother Theo and Nicole, though Purge is a relatively infrequent visitor to the embalming room. Theo explains that he is going to use an aspirator. As if to distract me from what I am seeing, he keeps up a friendly patter. The Spanish for vacuum is aspiradora. Before switching on the aspirator, Theo takes a cloth to the man's chin and wipes away a substance that looks, but surely doesn't taste, like chocolate syrup. I ask him how he copes with the unpleasantness of dealing with dead strangers' bodies and secretions. Like Arpad Vass, he says that he tries to focus on the positives. If there are parasites, or the person has dirty teeth, or they didn't wipe their nose before they died, you're improving the situation, making them more presentable. Theo is single. I ask him whether studying to be a mortician has been having a deleterious effect on his love life. He straightens up and looks at me. I'm short, I'm thin, I'm not rich. I would say my career choice is in fourth place in limiting my effectiveness as a single adult. It's possible that it helped. Within a year, you would be married. Next, Theo coats the face with what I assume to be some sort of disinfecting lotion, which looks a lot like shaving cream. The reason that it looks a lot like shaving cream, it turns out, is that it is. Theo slides a new blade into a razor. When you shave a decedent, it's really different. I bet. The skin isn't able to heal, so you have to be really careful about nicks. One shave per razor, and then you throw it away. I wonder whether the man, in his dying days, ever stood before a mirror, razor in hand, wondering if it might be his last shave, unaware of the actual last shave that fate had arranged for him. "Now we're going to set the features," says Theo. He lifts one of the man's eyelids and packs tufts of cotton underneath to fill out the lid the way the man's eyeballs once did. Oddly, the culture I associate most closely with cotton, the Egyptians, did not use their famous Egyptian cotton for plumping out withered eyes. The ancient Egyptians put pearl onions in there. Onions. Speaking for myself, if I had to have a small round martini garnish inserted under my eyelids, I would go with olives. On top of the cotton go a pair of eye caps. People would find it disturbing to find the eyes open, explains Theo, and then he slides down the lids. In the corner of my viewing screen, my brain displays a special pull-out graphic, an animated close-up of the little spurs in action. Madre de Dio, aspiradora. Come the day, you won't be seeing me in an open casket. As a feature of the common man's funeral, the open casket is a relatively recent development, around 150 years. According to Mac, it serves several purposes aside from providing what undertakers call the memory picture. It reassures the family that, one, their loved one is unequivocally dead and not about to be buried alive, And two, that the body in the casket is indeed their loved one and not the stiff from the container beside his. I read in the Principles and Practice of Embalming that it came into vogue as a way for embalmers to show off their skills. Mac disagrees, noting that long before embalming became commonplace, corpses on ice inside their caskets were displayed at funerals. I'm inclined to believe Mac, this being a book that includes the passage, "Many of the body tissues also possess some measure of immortality if they can be kept under proper conditions." Theoretically, it is possible in this way to grow a chicken heart to the size of the world. "Did you already go in the nose?" Nicole is holding aloft tiny chrome scissors. Theo says no. She goes in, first to trim the hair, then with the disinfectant. "It gives the decedent some dignity," she says, plunging wadded cotton into and out of his left nostril. I like the term decedent. It's as though the man weren't dead, but merely involved in some sort of protracted legal dispute. For evident reasons, mortuary science is awash with euphemisms. "Don't say stiff, corpse, cadaver," scolds the Principles and Practices of Embalming. "Say decedent, remains, or Mr. Blank. Don't say keep, say maintain preservation. Wrinkles are acquired facial markings. Decomposed brain that filters down through a damaged skull and bubbles out the nose is frothy purge." The last feature to be posed is the mouth, which will hang open if not held shut. Theo is narrating for Nicole, who is using a curved needle and heavy-duty string to suture the jaws together. "The goal is to re-enter through the same hole and come in between the teeth," says Theo. "Now she's coming out of the nostrils, across the septum, and then she's going to re-enter the mouth." "There are a variety of ways of closing the mouth," he adds. And then he begins talking about something called a needle injector. "I pose my own mouth to resemble the mouth of someone who is quietly horrified, and this works quite well to close Theo's mouth." The suturing proceeds in silence. Theo and Nicole step back and regard their work. Mac nods. Mr. Blank is ready for embalming. Modern embalming makes use of the circulatory system to deliver a liquid preservative to the body's cells to halt autolysis and put decay on hold. Just as blood in the vessels and capillaries once delivered oxygen and nutrients to the cells, now those same vessels, emptied of blood, are delivering embalming fluid. The first people known to attempt arterial embalming were a trio of Dutch biologists and anatomists named Swammerdam, Rusch, and Blanchard, who lived in the late 1600s. The early anatomists were dealing with a chronic shortage of bodies for dissection and consequently were motivated to come up with ways to preserve the ones they managed to obtain. Blanchard's textbook was the first to cover arterial embalming. He describes opening up an artery, flushing the blood out with water, and pumping in alcohol. I've been to frat parties like that. Arterial embalming didn't begin to catch on in earnest until the American Civil War. Up until this point, dead U.S. soldiers were buried more or less where they fell. Their families had to send a written request for disinterment and ship a coffin capable of being hermetically sealed to the nearest quartermaster office, whereupon the quartermaster officer would assign a team of men to dig up the remains and deliver them to the family. Often the coffins that the families sent were not hermetically sealed. Who knew what hermetically meant? Who knows now? And they soon began to stink and leak. At the urgent pleadings of the beleaguered delivery brigades, the army set about embalming its dead, some 35,000 in all. One fine day in 1861, a 24-year-old colonel named Elmer Ellsworth was shot and killed as he seized a Confederate flag from atop a hotel. His rank and courage a testimony to the motivating powers of a humiliating first name. The colonel was given a hero send-off and a first-class embalming at the hands of one Thomas Holmes, the father of embalming. The public filed past Elmer in his casket, looking every bit the soldier and nothing at all the decomposing body. Embalming received another boost 4 years later when Abe Lincoln's embalmed body traveled from Washington to his hometown in Illinois. The train ride amounted to a promotional tour for funerary embalming, for wherever the train stopped, people came to view him, and more than a few must have noted that he looked a whole lot better in his casket than Grandmama had looked in hers. Word spread and the practice grew, like a chicken heart, and soon the whole nation was sending their decedents in to be posed and preserved. After the war, Holmes set up a business selling his patented embalming fluid, Innominata, to embalmers, but otherwise began to distance himself from the mortuary trade. He opened a drugstore, manufactured root beer, and invested in a health spa, and between the three of them managed to squander his considerable savings. He never married and fathered no children, other than embalming, but it wouldn't be accurate to say he lived alone. According to Christine Quigley, author of The Corpse, A History, he shared his Brooklyn house with samples of his war-era handiwork. Embalmed bodies were stored in the closets, and heads sat on tables in the living room. Not all that surprisingly, Holmes began to go insane, spending his final years in and out of institutions. At 70, he was placing ads in mortuary trade journals for a rubber-coated canvas body removal bag that could, he suggested, double as a sleeping bag. Shortly before he died, Holmes is said to have requested that he not be embalmed, though whether this was a function of sanity or insanity was never made clear. Theo is feeling around on Mr. Blank's neck. "We're in search of the carotid artery," he announces. He cuts a short lengthwise slit in the man's neck. Because no blood flows, it is easy to watch, easy to think of the action as simply something a man does on his job, like cutting roofing material or slicing foam core, rather than what it would more normally be, murder. Now the neck has a secret pocket, and Theo slips his fingers into it. After some probing, he finds and raises the artery, which is then severed with a blade. The loose end is pink and rubbery and looks very much like what you blow into to inflate a whoopee cushion. A cannula is inserted into the artery and connected by a length of tubing to the canister of embalming fluid. Max starts the pump. Here is where it all begins to make sense. Within minutes, the man's face looks rejuvenated. The embalming fluid has rehydrated his tissues, filling out his sunken cheeks, his lined skin. His skin is pink now. The embalming fluid contains red coloring, no longer slack and papery. He looks healthy and surprisingly alive. This is why you don't just stick bodies in the refrigerator before an open casket funeral. Mac is telling me about a 97-year-old woman who looked 60 after her embalming. We had to paint in wrinkles or the family wouldn't recognize her. As hale and youthful as our Mr. Blank looks this morning, he will still eventually decompose. Mortuary embalming is designed to keep a cadaver looking fresh and uncadaverous for the funeral service, but not much longer. Anatomy departments amp up the process by using greater amounts and higher concentrations of formalin. These corpses may remain intact for years, though they take on a kind of pickled horror movie appearance. As soon as the water table comes up and the coffin gets wet, Mac allows, you're going to have the same kind of decomposition you would have if you hadn't done embalming. Water reverses the chemical reactions of embalming, he says. Funeral homes sell sealed vaults designed to keep air and water out, but even then the corpse's prospects for eternal comeliness are iffy. The body may contain bacteria spores, hardy suspended animation DNA pods, able to withstand extremes of temperature, dryness, and chemical abuse, including that of embalming. Eventually, the formaldehyde breaks down and the coast is clear for the spores to bring forth bacteria. Undertakers used to claim embalming was permanent, says Mac. If it meant making the sale on that family, believe me, that embalmer was going to say anything, agrees Thomas Chambers of the W.W. Chambers chain of funeral homes, whose grandfather walked the boundaries of taste when he distributed promotional calendars featuring a nude silhouette of a shapely woman above the mortuary slogan, "Beautiful Bodies by Chambers." The woman was not, as Jessica Mitford seemed to hint in The American Way of Death, a cadaver that the mortuary had embalmed. That would have been going too far, even for Grandpa Chambers. Embalming fluid companies used to encourage experimentation by sponsoring best-preserved body contests. The hope was that some undertaker, by craft or serendipity, would figure out the perfect balance of preservatives and hydrators, enabling his trade to preserve a body for years without mummifying it. Contestants were invited to submit photographs of decedents who had held up particularly well, along with a write-up of their formulas and methods. The winning entries and photos would be published in mortuary trade journals on the pre-Jessica Mitford assumption that no one outside the business ever cracked an issue of Casket and Sunnyside. I asked Mac what made the undertakers back off from their claims of eternal preservation. It was, as it so often is, a lawsuit. One man took them up on it. He bought a space in his mausoleum, and every 6 months he'd go in with his lunch and open up his mother's casket and visit her on his lunch hour. One especially wet spring, some moisture got in, and come to find, Mom had grown a beard. She was covered with mold. He sued and collected $25,000 from the mortuary. So they've stopped making that statement. Further discouragement has come from the Federal Trade Commission, whose 1982 funeral rule prohibited mortuary professionals from claiming that the coffins they sold provided eternal protection against decay. And that is embalming. It will make a good-looking corpse of you for your funeral, but it will not keep you from one day dissolving and reeking, from becoming a Halloween ghoul. It is a temporary preservative, like the nitrites in your sausages. Eventually, any meat, regardless of what you do to it, will wither and go off. The point is, no matter what you choose to do with your body when you die, it won't ultimately be very appealing. If you are inclined to donate yourself to science, you should not let images of dissection or dismemberment put you off. They are no more or less gruesome, in my opinion, than ordinary decay, or the sewing shut of your jaws via your nostrils for a funeral viewing. Even cremation, when you get right down to it, as W.E.D. Evans, former senior lecturer in morbid anatomy at the University of London, did in his 1963 book, The Chemistry of Death, isn't a pretty event. The skin and hair at once scorch, char, and burn. Heat coagulation of muscle protein may become evident at this stage, causing the muscles slowly to contract, and there may be a steady divarication of the thighs, with gradual developing flexion of the limbs. There is a popular idea that early in the cremation process, the heat causes the trunk to flex forwards violently, so that the body suddenly sits up, bursting open the lid of the coffin, but this has not been observed personally. Occasionally, there is a swelling of the abdomen before the skin and abdominal muscles char and split. The swelling is due to formation of steam and the expansion of gases in the abdominal contents. Destruction of the soft tissues gradually exposes part of the skeleton. The skull is soon devoid of covering, then the bones of the limbs appear. The abdominal contents burn fairly slowly, and the lungs more slowly still. It has been observed that the brain is specially resistant to complete combustion during cremation of the body. Even when the vault of the skull has broken and fallen away, the brain has been seen as a dark, fused mass with a rather sticky consistency. Eventually, the spine becomes visible as the viscera disappear. The bones glow whitely in the flames, and the skeleton falls apart. Drops of sweat bead the inside surface of Nicole's splash shield. We've been here more than an hour. It's almost over. Theo looks at Mac. Will we be suturing the anus? He turns to me. Otherwise, leakage can wick into the funeral clothing, and it's an awful mess. I don't mind Theo's matter-of-factness. Life contains these things, leakage and wickage and discharge, pus and snot and slime and gleet. We are biology. We are reminded of this at the beginning and the end, at birth and at death. In between, we do what we can to forget. Since our decedent will not be having a funeral service, it is up to Mac whether the students must take the final step. He decides to let it go. Unless the visitor wishes to see it, they look at me. No, thank you. Enough biology for today. Chapter 4. Dead Man Driving. Human Crash Test Dummies and the Ghastly, Necessary Science of Impact Tolerance. By and large, the dead aren't very talented. They can't play water polo, or lace up their boots, or maximize market share. They can't tell a joke, and they can't dance for beans. There is one thing dead people excel at. They're very good at handling pain. For instance, UM006, UM006 is a cadaver who recently journeyed across Detroit from the University of Michigan to the bioengineering building at Wayne State University. His job, which he will undertake at approximately 7 p.m. tonight, is to be hit in the shoulder with a linear impactor. His collarbone and scapula may break, but he will not feel a thing, nor will the injuries interfere with his day-to-day activities. By agreeing to be walloped in the shoulder, cadaver UM006 is helping researchers figure out how much force a human shoulder in a side impact car crash can withstand before it registers a serious injury. Over the past 60 years, the dead have helped the living work out human tolerance limits for skull slammings and chest skewerings, knee crammings and gut mashings, all the ugly, violent things that happen to a human being in a car crash. Once automobile manufacturers know how much force a skull or spine or shoulder can withstand, they can design cars that they hope will not exceed that force in a crash. You are perhaps wondering, as I did, why they don't use crash test dummies. This is the other side of the equation. A dummy can tell you how much force a crash is unleashing on various dummy body parts, but without knowing how much of a blow a real body part can take, the information is useless. You first need to know, for instance, that the maximum amount a rib cage can compress without damaging the soft, wet things inside is 2 3/4 inches. Then, should a dummy slam into a steering wheel of a newly designed car and register a chest deflection of 4 inches, you know the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, isn't going to be very happy with that car. The dead's first contribution to safe driving was the non-face-gashing windshield. The first Fords came without windshields, which is why you see pictures of early motorists wearing goggles. They weren't trying to affect a dashing World War I flying ace mean. They were keeping wind and bugs out of their eyes. The first windscreens were made of ordinary window glass, which served to cut the wind and, unfortunately, the driver's face in the event of a crash. Even with the early laminated glass windshields, which were in use from the 1930s to the mid-1960s, front seat passengers were walking away from accidents with gruesome, gaping, scalp-to-chin lacerations. Heads would hit the windshield, knock out a head-shaped hole in the glass, and, on their violent bouncing return back through that hole, get sliced open on the jagged edges. Tempered glass, the follow-up innovation, was strong enough to keep heads from smashing through, but the concern then became that striking the stiffer glass would cause brain damage. The less a material gives, the more damaging the forces of the impact. Think ice rink versus lawn. Neurologists knew that a concussion from a forehead impact was accompanied by some degree of skull fracture. You can't give a dead man a concussion, but you can check his skull for hairline cracks, and this is what researchers did. At Wayne State, cadavers were leaned forward over a simulated car window and dropped from varying heights, simulating varying speeds, so that their foreheads hit the glass. Contrary to popular impression, impact test cadavers were not typically ushered into the front seats of actual running automobiles, driving being one of the other things cadavers don't do well. More often than not, the cadaver was either dropped or it remained still while some sort of controllable impacting device was directed at it. The study showed that tempered glass, provided it wasn't too thick, was unlikely to create forces strong enough to cause concussion. Windshields today have even more give, enabling the modern-day head to undergo a 30-mile-per-hour unbelted car crash straight into a wall and come away with little to complain about, save a welt and an owner whose driving skills are up there with the average cadavers. Despite forgiving windshields and knobless, padded dashboards, brain damage is still the major culprit in car crash fatalities. Very often the bang to the head isn't all that severe. It's the combination of banging it into something and whipping it in one direction and then rapidly back at high speeds, rotation this is called, that tends to cause serious brain damage. If you hit the head without any rotation, it takes a huge amount of force to knock you out, says Wayne State Bioengineering Center Director Albert King. Similarly, if you rotate the head without hitting anything, it's hard to cause severe damage. High-speed rear-enders sometimes do this. The brain is whipped back and forth so fast that sheer forces tear open the veins on its surface. In the run-of-the-mill crash, there's some of each, neither of which is very high, but you can get a severe head injury. The sideways jarring of a side impact crash is especially notorious for putting passengers in comas. King and some of his colleagues are trying to get a handle on what exactly is happening to the brain in these banging, whipping around scenarios. Across town at Henry Ford Hospital, the team has been filming cadavers' heads with a high-speed X-ray video camera during simulated crashes to find out what's going on inside the skull. So far, they're finding a lot more sloshing of the brain, as King put it, with more rotation than was previously thought to occur. The brain traces out a kind of figure eight, says King. It is something best left to skaters. When brains do this, they get what's called diffuse axonal injury, potentially fatal tears and leaks in the microtubules of the brain's axons. Chest injuries are the other generous contributor to crash fatalities. This was true even before the dawn of the automobile. The great anatomist Vesalius in 1557 described the burst aorta of a man thrown from his horse. In the days before seat belts, the steering wheel was the most lethal item in a car's interior. In a head-on collision, the body would slide forward and the chest would slam into the steering wheel, often with enough force to fold the rim of the wheel around the column in the manner of a closing umbrella. We had a guy take a tree head-on, and there was an N from the steering wheel. The car was a gnash imprinted in the center of his chest, recalls Don Huelke, a safety researcher who spent the years from 1961 through 1970 visiting the scene of every car accident fatality in the county surrounding the University of Michigan and recording what happened and how. Steering wheel columns up through the 60s were narrow, sometimes only 6 or 7 inches in diameter. Just as a ski pole will sink into the snow without its circular basket, a steering column with its rim flattened back will sink into a body. In an unfortunate design decision, the steering wheel shaft of the average automobile was angled and positioned to point straight at the driver's heart. In a head-on, you'd be impaled in pretty much the last place you'd want to be impaled. Even when the metal didn't penetrate the chest, the impact alone was often fatal. Despite its thickness, an aorta ruptures relatively easily. This is because every other second, it has a 1 pound weight suspended from it, the human heart filled with blood. Get the weight moving with enough force, as happened in blunt impacts from steering wheels, and even the body's largest blood vessel can't take the strain. If you insist on driving around in vintage cars with no seatbelt on, try to time your crashes for the systole blood-squeezed-out portion of your heartbeat. With all this in mind, bioengineers and automobile manufacturers, GM notably, began ushering cadavers into the driver's seats of crash simulators, front halves of cars on machine-accelerated sleds that are stopped abruptly to mimic the forces of a head-on collision. The goal, one of them anyway, was to design a steering column that would collapse on impact, absorbing enough of the shock to present serious injury to the heart and its supporting vessels. Hoods are now designed to do this too, so that even cars in relatively minor accidents have completely jackknifed hoods, the idea being that the more the car crumples, the less you do. GM's first collapsible steering wheel shaft, introduced in the early 1960s, cut the risk of death in a head-on collision by half. And so it went. The collective cadaver resume boasts contributions to government legislation for lap shoulder belts, airbags, dashboard padding, and recessed dashboard knobs. Autopsy files from the 1950s and 1960s contain more than a few X-ray images of human heads with radio knobs embedded in them. It was not pretty work. In countless seatbelt studies, car manufacturers, seeking to save money, spent years trying to prove that seatbelts caused more injuries than they prevented, and thus shouldn't be required. Bodies were strapped in and crashed, and their innards were then probed for ruptures and manglings. To establish the tolerance limits of the human face, cadavers have been seated with their cheekbones in the firing lines of rotary strikers. They've had their lower legs broken by simulated bumpers and their upper legs shattered by smashed-in dashboards. It is not pretty, but it is most certainly justifiable. Because of changes that have come about as a result of cadaver studies, it's now possible to survive a head-on crash into a wall at 60 miles per hour. In a 1995 Journal of Trauma article entitled Humanitarian Benefits of Cadaver Research on Injury Prevention, Albert King calculated that vehicle safety improvements that have come about as a result of cadaver research have saved an estimated 8,500 lives each year since 1987. For every cadaver that rode the crash sleds to test three-point seatbelts, 61 lives per year have been saved. For every cadaver that took an airbag in the face, 147 people per year survive otherwise fatal head-ons. For every corpse whose head has hammered a windshield, 68 lives per year are saved. Unfortunately, King did not have these figures handy in 1978 when Chairman John Moss of the House Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations called a hearing to investigate the use of human cadavers in car crash testing. Representative Moss said he felt a personal repugnance about this practice. He said that there had developed within NHTSA, quote, a sort of cult that finds this is a necessary tool. He believed that there had to be another way to go about it. He wanted proof that dead people in crashing cars behave exactly like living ones, proof that, as exasperated researchers pointed out, could never be obtained because it would mean subjecting a series of live humans to exactly the same high-force impacts as a series of dead humans. Oddly, Representative Moss was not a squeamish man when it came to dead bodies. He had worked briefly in a funeral parlor before he entered politics. Nor was he an especially conservative man. He was a Democrat, a pro-safety reformer. What had got him agitated, said King, who testified at the hearing, was this. He had been working to pass legislation to make airbags mandatory and was infuriated by a cadaver test that showed an airbag causing more injury than a seatbelt. Airbags sometimes do injure, even kill, particularly if the passenger is leaning forward or otherwise OOP, out of position. But in this case, to be fair to Moss, the airbag body was older and probably frailer. Moss was an oddity, an automotive safety lobbyer taking a stand against cadaver research. In the end, with the support of the National Academy of Sciences, the Georgetown Center for Bioethics, the National Catholic Conference, a chairman of a noted medical school's anatomy department who stated that, quote, such experiments are probably as highly respectful as medical school anatomy dissections and less destructive to the human body, end quote. And representatives of the Quaker, Hindu, and Reformed Judaism religions, the committee concluded that Moss himself was a tad out of position. There is no better stand-in for a live human in a car crash than a dead one. Lord knows the alternatives have been tried. In the dawn of impact science, researchers would experiment on themselves. Albert King's predecessor at the Bioengineering Center, Lawrence Patrick, volunteered himself as a human crash test dummy for years. He has ridden the crash sled some 400 times and been slammed in the chest by a 22-pound metal pendulum. He has hurled one knee repeatedly against a metal bar outfitted with a load cell. Some of Patrick's students were equally courageous, if courageous is the word. A 1965 Patrick paper on knee impacts reports that student volunteers seated in crash sleds endured knee impacts equivalent to a force of 1,000 pounds. The injury threshold was estimated at 1,400 pounds. His 1963 study, Facial Injuries, Cause and Prevention, includes a photograph of a young man who appears to be resting peacefully with his eyes shut. Closer inspection hints that, in fact, something not at all peaceful is about to unfold. For starters, the man is using a book entitled Head Injuries as a headrest. Uncomfortable, but probably pleasanter than reading it. Hovering just above the man's cheek is a forbidding metal rod identified in the caption as a gravity impactor. The text informs us that the volunteer waited several days for the swelling to subside, and then the test was continued up to the energy limit, which he could endure. Here was the problem. Impact data that doesn't exceed the injury threshold is of minimal use. You need those folks who don't feel pain. You need cadavers. Moss wanted to know why animals couldn't be used in automotive impact testing, and indeed they have been. A description of the 8th STAP car crash and field demonstration conference, which appears in the introduction to its proceedings, begins like a child's recollection of a trip to the circus. We saw chimpanzees riding rocket sleds, a bear on an impact swing. We observed a pig, anesthetized and placed in a sitting position on the swing in the harness, crashed into a deep-dished steering wheel. Pigs were popular subjects because of their similarities to humans in terms of their organ setup, as one industry insider put it, and because they can be coaxed into a useful approximation of a human sitting in a car. As far as I can tell, they are also similar to a human sitting in a car in terms of their intelligence setup, their manners setup, and pretty much everything else, excluding possibly their use of cup holders and ability to work the radio buttons, but that is neither here nor there. In more recent years, animals have typically been used only when functioning organs are needed, and cadavers cannot oblige. Baboons, for example, have been subjected to violent sideways head rotations in order to study why side impact crashes so often send passengers into comas. Researchers, in turn, were subject to violent animal rights protests. Live dogs were recruited to study aortic rupture. For unknown reasons, it has proved difficult to experimentally rupture a cadaver aorta. There is one type of automotive impact study in which animals are still used, even though cadavers would be vastly more accurate, and that is the pediatric impact study. No child donates his remains to science, and no researcher wants to bring up body donation with grieving parents, even though the need for data on children and airbag injuries has been obvious and dire. "It's a real problem," Albert King told me. "We try to scale it from baboons, but the strength is all different, and a kid's skull is not completely formed. It changes as it grows." In 1993, a research team at the Heidelberg University School of Medicine had the courage to attempt a series of impact studies on children and the audacity to do it without consent. The press got hold of it, the clergy got involved, and the facility was shut down. Child data aside, the blunt impact tolerance limits of the human body's vital pieces have long ago been worked out, and today's dead are being recruited mainly for impact studies of the body's outlying regions, ankles, knees, feet, shoulders. In the old days, King told me, people involved in severe crashes ended up in the morgue. No one cares about a dead man's shattered ankle. Now these guys are surviving because of the airbag, and we have to worry about these things. You have people with both ankles and knees damaged, and they will never walk right again. It's a major disability now. Tonight, at Wayne State's Impact Lab, a cadaver shoulder impact is taking place, and King has been gracious enough to invite me to watch. Actually, he didn't invite me. I asked if I could watch, and he agreed to it. Still, considering what I'd be seeing and how sensitive the public is to these things, and further considering that Albert King has read my writing and knows it doesn't exactly read like the International Journal of Crash Worthiness, he was pretty darn gracious. Wayne State has been involved in impact research since 1939, longer than any other university. On the wall above the landing of the front stairs of the Bioengineering Center, a banner proclaims, "Celebrating 50 years of moving forward with impact." It is 2001, which suggests that for 12 years now, no one has thought to take down the banner, which you kind of expect from engineers. King is on his way to the airport, so he leaves me with fellow bioengineering professor John Kavanaugh, who will be overseeing tonight's impact. Kavanaugh looks at once like an engineer and a young John Voight, if that's possible. He has a laboratory complexion, pale and unlined, and regular-looking brown hair. When he talks or shifts his glance, his eyebrows rise and his forehead draws together, giving him a more or less permanent look of mild worry. Kavanaugh brings me downstairs to the impact lab. It is a typical university lab with ancient, jerry-rigged equipment and decor that runs to block-lettered safety reminders. Kavanaugh introduces me to Matt Mason, tonight's research assistant, and Deb Marth, for whose PhD dissertation the impact is being done, and then he disappears upstairs. I glance around the room for UM006, the way as a child I used to scan the basement for the thing that reaches through the banisters to grab your legs. He isn't here yet. A crash test dummy sits on a sled railing. Its upper body rests on its thighs, head on knees, as though collapsed in despair. It has no arms, perhaps the source of the despair. Matt is linking up high-speed video cameras to a pair of computers and to the linear impactor. The impactor is a formidably sized piston fired by compressed air and mounted on a steel base the size of a fairground pony. From the hallway, a sound of clattering wheels. "Here he comes," says Deb. UM006 lies on a gurney, being wheeled by a muscular man with gray hair and rambunctious eyebrows, dressed like Marth in surgical scrubs. "I am Ruhan," says the man beneath the eyebrows. "I am the cadaver man." He holds out a gloved hand. I wave to show him that I'm not wearing gloves. Ruhan comes from Turkey, where he was a doctor. For a former doctor, whose job now entails diapering and dressing cadavers, he has an admirably upbeat disposition. I ask him if it's difficult to dress a dead man and how he does it. Ruhan describes the process, then stops. Have you ever been to a nursing home? It's like that. UM006 is dressed this evening in a smurf blue leotard and matching tights. Beneath the tights he wears a diaper, for leakage. The neckline of his leotard is wide and scooped, like a dancer's. Ruhan confirms that the cadaver leotards are purchased from a dancer's supply house. They would be disgusted if they knew. To ensure anonymity, the dead man's face is masked by a snug-fitting white cotton hood. He looks like someone about to rob a bank, someone who meant to pull pantyhose over his head but got it wrong and used an athletic sock. Matt sets down his laptop and helps Ruhan lift the cadaver into the car seat, which sits on a table beside the impactor. Ruhan is right. It's nursing home work. Dressing, lifting, arranging. The distance between the very old, sick, frail person and the dead one is short, with a poorly marked border. The more time you spend with the invalid elderly, I have seen both my parents in this state, the more you come to see extreme old age as a gradual easing into death. The old and the dying sleep more and more, until one day they sleep all the time. They often become more and more immobile, until one day they can do no more than lie or sit however the last person positioned them. They have as much in common with UM006 as they do with you and me. I find the dead easier to be around than the dying. They're not in pain, not afraid of death. There are no awkward silences and conversations that dance around the obvious. They aren't scary. The half hour I spent with my mother as a dead person was easier by far than the many hours I spent with her as a live person, dying and in pain. Not that I wished her dead. I'm just saying it's easier. Cadavers, once you get used to them, and you do that quite fast, are surprisingly easy to be around. Which is good, because at the moment it's just he and I. Matt is in the next room. Deb has gone to look for something. UM006 was a big, meaty man, still is. His tights are lightly stained. His leotard shows up his lumpy, fallen midsection. The aging superhero who can't be bothered to wash his costume. His hands are mittened with the same cotton as his head. It was probably done to depersonalize him, as is done with the hands of anatomy lab cadavers, but for me it has the opposite effect. It makes him seem vulnerable and toddler-like. 10 minutes pass. Sharing a room with a cadaver is only mildly different from being in a room alone. They are the same sort of company as people across from you on subways or in airport lounges. There, but not there. Your eyes keep going back to them, for lack of anything more interesting to look at, and then you feel bad for staring. Deb is back. She is checking accelerometers that she has painstakingly mounted to exposed areas of the cadaver's bones, on the scapula, clavicle, vertebrae, sternum, and head. By measuring how fast the body accelerates on impact, the devices essentially give you the force of the hit, as measured in Gs, gravities. After the test, Deb will autopsy the shoulder area and catalog the damage at this particular speed. What she is after is the injury threshold and the forces needed to generate it. The information will be used to develop shoulder instrumentation for the SID, the side impact dummy. A side impact accident is one in which the cars collide at 90 degrees, bumper to door, the kind that often take place at four-way intersections when one party hasn't bothered to stop at the light or heed the stop sign. Lap shoulder belts and dashboard airbags are engineered to protect against the forward-heaving forces of a head-on crash. They do little for a person in a side impact crash. The other thing working against you in this type of crash is the immediacy of the other car. There is no engine or trunk and rear seat to absorb the blow. There are a couple inches of metal door. This is also the reason it took so long for side airbags to begin appearing in cars. With no hood to collapse, the sensors have to sense the impact immediately, and the old ones weren't up to the task. Deb knows all about this because she works as a design engineer at Ford and was the person who implemented the side airbags in the 1998 Town Car. She doesn't look like an engineer. She has magazine model skin and a wide, white, radiant smile and thick, shiny brown hair pulled back in a loose ponytail. If Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock had a child together, it would look like Deb Marth. The cadaver before you, M006, was hit at a faster speed, 15 miles per hour, which, were this a real side impact accident with a passenger door to absorb some of the energy of the impact, would translate to being hit by a car going perhaps 25 or 30 miles per hour. The impact broke his collarbone and scapula and fractured 5 ribs. Ribs are more important than you think. When you breathe, you not only need to move your diaphragm to pull air into your lungs, you need the muscles attached to your ribs and the ribs themselves. If all your ribs break, your rib cage can't help inflate your lungs the way it's supposed to, and you will find it very hard to breathe. It is a condition called flail chest, and people die from it. Flail chest is one of the other things that makes side impacts especially dangerous. Ribs are easier to break from the side. The rib cage is built to be compressed from the front, sternum to spine. That's how it moves when you breathe. Up to a point, that is. Compress it too far and you can, in the words of Don Hulke, split the heart completely in half as you would a pear. A rib cage is not built for the sideways press. Slam it violently from the side and its tines tend to snap. Matt is still working on the setup. Deb is intent on her accelerometers. Normally, accelerometers are screwed into place, but if she were to screw them into the bone would be weakened and would break more easily in the impact. Instead, she secures them to the bone with wire ties and then wedges wood scrims underneath to tighten the fit. As she works, she slips the wire cutters into and out of the cadaver's mittened hand as though he were a surgical nurse, another way for him to help. With the radio playing and the three of us talking, the room has a feeling of late-night congeniality. I find myself thinking that it's nice for UM006 to have company. There can be no lonelier state of being than that of being a corpse. Here in the lab, he's part of something, part of the group, center of everyone's attention. Of course, these are stupid thoughts, for UM006 is a mass of tissue and bone who can no more feel loneliness than he can feel Marth's fingers probing the flesh around his collarbone. But that's how I feel about it at the moment. It is past 9 now. UM006 has begun to put out a subtle, gamey smell, the mild but unmistakable fetor of a butcher shop on a hot afternoon. How long, I ask, can he stay out at room temperature before he starts to... Marth waits for me to finish my sentence. Change. She says maybe half a day. She is looking put upon. The ties aren't tight enough, and the crazy glue's not crazy anymore. It's going to be a long night. John Cavanaugh calls down that there's pizza upstairs, and the three of us, Deb, Matt Mason, and I, leave the dead man by himself. It feels a little rude. On the way upstairs, I ask Deb how she wound up working with dead bodies for a living. "Oh, I always wanted to do cadaver research," she says, with exactly the same enthusiasm and sincerity with which a more usual individual would say, "I always wanted to be an archaeologist," or, "I always wanted to live by the sea." John was so psyched, nobody wants to do cadaver research. In her office, she takes a bottle of perfume called Happy from a desk drawer. "So I smell something else," she explains. She has promised to give me some papers, and while she searches for them, I look at a pile of snapshots on her desk. And then, very quickly, I don't. The photographs are close-ups from a previous cadaver's shoulder autopsy, meaty red and parted skin. Matt looks down at the pile. "These aren't your vacation shots, are they, Deb?" By 11:30, all that remains is to get UM006 into driving posture. He is slumped and leaning to one side. He is the guy next to you on the plane, asleep and inching closer to your shoulder. John Cavanaugh takes the cadaver by the ankles and pushes back on him to try to get him to sit up in the seat. He steps back. The cadaver slides back toward him. He pushes him again. This time he holds him while Matt encircles UM006's knees and the entire circumference of the car seat with duct tape. "This probably won't make it to the 101 uses list," observes Matt. "His head's wrong," says John. "It needs to be straight ahead." More duct tape. The radio is playing the Romantics. "That's what I like about you." He's slumping again. "Try the winch?" Deb loops a canvas strap under his arms and presses a button that raises a ceiling-mounted motor winch. The cadaver shrugs slowly and holds it, like a borscht belt comedian. He lifts slightly from his seat and is lowered back down, sitting straighter now. "Good, perfect," says John. Everyone steps back. UM006 has a comic's timing. He waits a beat, two beats, then slips forward again. You have to laugh. The absurdity of the scene and the punch-drunk hour are making it hard not to. Deb gets some pieces of foam to prop up his back, which seems to do the trick. Matt runs a final check of the connections. The radio, I'm not making this up, is playing Hit Me With Your Best Shot. 5 more minutes pass. Matt fires the piston. It sounds a loud bang as it shoots out, though the impact itself is silent. UM006 falls over, not like a villain shot in a Hollywood movie, but slowly, like an off-balance laundry sack. He falls over onto a foam pad that has been set out for this purpose, and John and Deb step forward to steady him. And that's that. Without the screech of skidding tires and the crunch and fold of metal, an impact is neither violent nor disturbing. Distilled to its essence, controlled and planned, it is now simply science, no longer tragedy. The family of UM006 does not know what happened to him this evening. They know only that he donated his remains for use in medical education or research. There are many reasons for this. At the time a person or his family decides to donate his remains, no one knows what those remains will be used for, or even at which university. The body goes to a morgue facility at the university to which it was donated, but may be shipped, as was UM006, from that school to another. For a family to be fully informed of what is happening to their loved one, the information would have to come from the researchers themselves after they have taken receipt of the body, or body part, but before they run their test. As a result of the subcommittee hearings that was sometimes done, automotive impact researchers who received federal NHTSA funding and who had not made it clear in their willed body consent forms that the remains might be used for research were required to contact families prior to the experiment. According to Rolf Eppinger, chief of the NHTSA Biomechanics Research Center, it was rare for the family to renege on the deceased's consent. I spoke with Mike Walsh, who worked for one of NHTSA's main contractors, Calspan. It was Walsh who, once the body arrived, called the family to set up a meeting, preferably, owing to the highly perishable state of unembalmed remains, within a day or two after the death. You would think, as principal investigator on these studies, that Walsh would have delegated the enormously uncomfortable task to someone else, but Walsh preferred to do it himself. He told the families precisely how their loved one would be used and why. The entire program was explained to them. Some studies were sled impact studies, some were pedestrian impact studies, some were in full-scale crash vehicles. Clearly, Walsh has a gift. Out of 42 families contacted, only 2 revoked consent, not because of the nature or specifics of the study, but because they had thought the body was going to be used for organ donation. I asked Walsh whether any family members had asked to see a copy of the study when it was published. No one had. We got the impression, quite frankly, that we were giving people more information than they wanted to hear. In England and other Commonwealth countries, researchers and anatomy instructors sidestep the possibility of family or public disapproval by using body parts and prosections, the name given to embalmed cadaver segments used in anatomy labs, rather than whole cadavers. England's anti-vivisectionists, as animal rights activists are called there, are as outspoken as America's, and the things that outrage them are more encompassing and, dare I say, nonsensical. To give you a